For hundreds of years in the Western world, we have been told or have assumed that indigenous peoples are genetically inferior and, like children, are thus in need of protection. That the protection offered has been the conscious or unconscious attempt at total annihilation is a sidebar for now. The notion that science was at the core of what justified attitudes and laws governing generations of indigenous peoples is important. Science is important because 20th century science is validating what indigenous peoples have been saying for thousands of years. Take Werner Herzenberg, he of the famous uncertainty principle, who suggested that we can never know what nature is like because in order to observe it, we must pin it down and thus change it. Now, an indigenous man, a chief of his people, steeped in the methodologies of his own and the dominant culture, says ancient indigenous modalities may be valid ways to prove what his culture has said all along. He says the quality of generosity is actually a law, not being generous will kill you, and this can be proven through the indigenous modality of the vision quest. Of course, Richard Atleo prefers the word Usamich, but we'll get into that. Our guest today is Umik, Dr. E. Richard Atleo, hereditary chief of the Ahusat, grandson of Kista, the last of the Ahusat whalers. He's a research affiliate at the University of Manitoba and author of Sawak, A New Chatnalt Worldview. It was a delight to hear your presentation today at the Center for World Indigenous Studies and to read your book, and to gain a kind of intimate access to your culture's cosmology that I consider quite an honor, and by reading the book and hearing you speak today. Thank you for that opportunity.
You're welcome.
Can you tell us about your ancestral homeland, the territory of the Nutchatnulth people?
My ancestral home, yes, a place called Ahus, from which we get the modern term Ahuset, which actually means people of Ahus. But as is usual in initial interactions with newcomers to the land, Ahus became Ahuset through a misunderstanding. So to call a place Ahuset is very much like calling a Seattleite, a person from Seattle, for example, or Vancouverite as a person from Vancouver, and that becomes the name of the place. Well, so that's what happened to all of our communities. West coast of Vancouver Island, we now call ourselves Nutchatnulth because that's our own designation of a people that live along the mountains, and that's what the name means, people who live along the mountains. I'm not sure what else to say about my ancestral homeland.
Well, that Nutchatnulth was bastardized to be Nootka at one time, is that correct?
Nootka is, yes, when Captain Cook, there's an official literary version of Captain Cook's arrival, and there's the oral version, which I will provide. The Nootka, the Muchlet people, the Muwachet people who lived in that area, have the story that it was foggy when Captain Cook arrived and that he was lost in the fog. And so they said to him, Nutkshi'i, and probably with a chorus of arms, because Nutkshi'i means to go around the corner or around the point to safe harbor. It doesn't have safe harbor in there, but that's the indication of the word or the phrase, Nutkshi'i. And probably over the ocean waves and wind and so on, Nutkshi'i would sound a bit like Nootka over a distance. And so we became known as Nootka as a result.
To get a sense of what part of the world that is, the west part of Vancouver Island near Clackwat Sound.
Exactly, yes.
I understand that you are a hereditary chief, and I'm wondering, you don't live in your ancestral homeland, and yet you're a hereditary chief. So can you tell us about your responsibilities as chief?
Yes, the contemporary hereditary chief is a person that, as the term suggests, descends from a line of people who were hereditary leaders within the community and had very specific and heavy responsibilities to the land, to resources, to the people, and to manage the reality that as they perceived it. in an attempt to find a way to balance the contrary forces that are found in reality, the forces of creation, forces of destruction, and all of the contrary forces that human beings experience in their everyday lives, whether it's in the ancient way or the contemporary way. And not an easy task, and demands strength, demands faith, demands all kinds of things that we really, I don't think, possess today.
And so as chief, what kinds of things are you expected to do?
There are practical family responsibilities. For example, my brother married a woman who brought a child into the marriage. And the child was not connected to the father. And so in order to make a meaningful connection for that child, we performed a ceremony of adoption using our songs, using our rituals. And as a result, that child became a very responsible member and continues to this day to be a responsible member of our community, holding responsible positions. As a matter of fact, surpassing many of my blood relatives in terms of commitment, responsibility, and so on. The responsibility of a chief then is to provide the context, the framework for certain kinds of issues that may arise, a framework in which to resolve issues that may arise in the community, such as an issue of identity for this particular child. We provide a framework for marriage ceremonies, for international agreements with fish farms, for treaty negotiations. The treaty negotiations being conducted are conducted in our name. So while we may not be directly hands-on involved in the treaty, it is done in our name.
Yeah, I'm thinking the modern, North American culture. My parents live in Chicago. My mother's family is in Miami and Cuba. My dad's family is in Chicago and California. Here I'm living in the Seattle area. So we understand that in the quote-unquote dominant culture, this is normal. But you live 1,000 miles away from home, roughly. So you're still able to conduct business in that way.
Well, first I want to address the issue of what was called diaspora today during our discussions. We have a diaspora that is created by conditions of colonization, by the conditions of constitutionalism within Canada that created reserves and created certain conditions that in order for anyone that became successful in school to be able to put their success to practical use, they had to leave the community because there was no work within our communities. There were massive kinds of restrictions to our people over the most of the 20th century, for some of which we're not allowed to move without permission, for most of which we're not allowed to get loans. Our reserves were special areas where they had no real commercial value. We couldn't use our lands for commercial purposes until recently. And so with all these restrictions, it was just not reasonable for, if we wanted to make a life of any kind, we had to leave, go to the cities and places of employment. And so our people are scattered. But traditionally we had a concept of what we call tla'a and hilstis, which means outside and inside. Literally, in the modern terminology, we'd call them summer homes and winter homes. And so now I've extended that concept to the diaspora. In Winnipeg, I am tla'a. I am outside. And when I go home, I am back, hilstis, back home in the interior. And so I want to maintain that sense of connection because through email, through modern technology, distance is really not that relevant in terms of communication. So we watch our children and relatives on the screen, through modern technology. You can talk to them and watch them on the screen, on the computer screen.
Yeah, and with indigenous technologies, non-locality is the concept anyway, isn't it?
No. Yes. So. Yes, that's true.
I understand you were the first Aboriginal man to earn a doctorate in British Columbia. What was that like?
Most amazing. When it came time to graduate, the dean who was making the announcement forgot that he was supposed to make this kind of announcement. So I passed through and was sort of knighted by the president of the university. And then when I returned to the audience, there were several thousand of us graduating from UBC. He said, I forgot. And so he had me stand up again and announce that I was the first Aboriginal in British Columbia. I often was congratulated for that, but it was very much a mixed blessing because in the 1930s, all the students in grade 8 took the same examination. The highest score in the 1930s in that 1 year was a gentleman from my reserve. And he was not allowed to go to high school. I use that particular example, a true story, because I, graduating in the late 1980s with a doctorate degree, the first one in British Columbia, was actually a disgrace. It marked a tremendous loss to British Columbia, Canada, and the world that so many talented people were not allowed to express, not allowed to fulfill themselves, not allowed their intelligence, the free rein to perform as they could have quite easily.
It was a black mark on the province.
Yes, that's one way to look at it, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if having a foot in each world then opened you up to grief from some of the elders in your village.
Opened up to?
Well, there's a story in your book about how you were talking in your given tongue, your native language, and someone said, you sound like a white man.
Oh, yes, yes. The process of Western education changed the cadence of my original language. And it was like putting it on fast forward, I suppose, because it sounded funny to my relatives. And that was quite a shock for me because I was 13. I remember I was 13 years old when it first happened. I was speaking my language, and my aunt said, in my language, she said, he sounds like a white person talking. And that cut me to the heart. She didn't realize it, of course. She didn't mean any harm either, you know, but it was just an observation, but it was a cutting observation. And
has it been difficult to be equally conversant in both worlds? You have a doctorate in, you know, so the dominant culture, and yet obviously this book of research on your own culture is amazing. So you're a historian and researcher of your own culture. So you have a foot equally in both worlds. Has this given you grief in your homeland for this, I guess, catering to the white man's ways, to put it bluntly?
Yes, I think there's bound to be some misunderstanding and some misgivings. On the one hand, our responsible leaders, elders, parents in the community, they've always encouraged their children to get an education all throughout the 20th century. But on the other hand, we have this oppression. We had this oppression. We had the differences. When a person did become successful, there was some resentment of that in the community. And so there's some put down of anyone with a PhD, anyone with a doctorate degree. And so there's some inconsistency there, which is actually quite natural. I see it as being very natural. And it will take time for the transition to take place before people are able to recognize the value in a Western education. It isn't a complete education in my view, but it's a very valuable form. It's a necessary kind of education because that's the Western education, the technology, the science, that is our contemporary and very necessary environment that we need to orient ourselves to without losing our own identity. And that's the challenge.
Yeah.